Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. You'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalog of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. But we will get started on today's episode where we will be talking to one Katja Pedersen. Katja is working full-time with teaching and does seminars online and workshops in both Europe and the US. She also speaks at conferences, weekly group classes in obedience, nose work, and pet dog training, as well as one-to-one behavior consults as part of her work. For the past 10 years, Katja has been doing a clicker training education in Denmark and is passionate about spreading the word about clicker training. This clicker training education she is now also running in the UK, and her focus is to help animals and humans getting a higher rate of choice in their life and helping people get fluency in their training skills. She's been doing clicker training since she crossed over in 2008 when she did the Canis instructor course in Norway and have competed successfully in the highest level of obedience, tracking, and search and rescue. She has also been working with drug detection work over the past few years. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Katja to the show today, who is patiently waiting by. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your evening to come and hang out with us. You always hang out with us at Animal Training Academy anyway, but to come hang out with us in this format at Animal Training Academy, we appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to talking to you.
You've been a part of ATA now for 2 years, 3 years?
I don't know, actually. Something like that, yes.
So we have been mutually admiring each other. But
well, I've been following ATA for a long time. It kind of took me a long time to actually become a member. And I don't really know why, because a lot of people were telling me how amazing it was. And I saw the stuff that was shared publicly was awesome, but it took me a while to sign up, but I never regretted it. It's an amazing community.
And I think you are part of numerous amazing communities. I was told your name right when ATA first started, actually, by someone in Denmark, Frank Bodka.
Oh. Yeah.
Have I said his last name correct?
Yeah, I think it would be Frank Bütker, probably.
That's what I
see. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what you said. He had, I think, Dr. Bedos.
He had Goliath, who we're so appreciative of Animal Training Academy, because Goliath taught us so much. Sadly, not with us anymore. So let's dedicate the second episode to Goliath.
Yeah.
Because it's Frank's ripples, potentially, that you're here with us today now.
Yeah. Well, I actually only met Frank in person at the first Clicker Expo in Denmark, I think. Up until then, it was just on social media, and he was working with Jan Østergaard, who was a Canis instructor. So from that community, and then again, Denmark is a tiny country. So everyone doesn't know each other, but I would say close by, we are not that many people here and not that many people with a passion for dog training.
Yeah, but the other community I was talking about is the Canis one, and we've been fortunate to have Jan on here on the show, and he's part of our community, and Morten on the show, and I just love the it's the same science and the same tools, but just a little bit of a different focus, would you say, on some of the aspects?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're all working under the same umbrella, if we can call it that. But Kenny's has some things that we are very focused on, that we really pay attention to, and that is kind of the Kenny's style of training.
Mm.
I would say that. So probably because we have so much focus on shaping and capturing and setting the environment. So the main difference would probably be that there's not a lot of luring in this style of training. Not saying that either things are better than the other, but that's kind of what we are taught in King is it's to capture and shape behaviors using as little help as possible. While still making it clear to the animal, because obviously we don't want them to just wait and guess and guess and guess. We want them to get it right. But what I think it's creating is trainers that are very good at observing behavior and at setting the environment for the behavior to actually happen. So I am very grateful that I met Morten and Cecilia.
Yeah, and I love watching your videos and Jan's videos and Morten's videos and seeing how what you've just described looks were very, I'm thinking of Jan's videos. I love Jan's videos and it's very still, just completely still body position and these dogs doing these really great behaviors.
Yeah. And yet there are so many cues in there, but it's, so what I found is that if people look at a lot of the Kenny's videos is that they would ask, how would the dog know? And even the question, does the dog read your mind? And I'm thinking, oh, that would be really cool if they did that. But there's so many cues. If you look at how we deliver the food, that's a huge cue. How we stand, how where we look, all of those things are huge cues. And I usually say that because our cues are that subtle, it's very loud for the dog and easy to pick up. Whereas if we were moving a lot and talking a lot, it would be, those cues would get lost. But again, it's a preference. So for me, I find it really useful because when I'm training for competition obedience, you're not allowed to do a lot of stuff anyway. So having those cues in how I feed and which foot I have my weight on is very valuable to me.
I love it. I learned so much, even just then in that little 2-minute segment of you talking, I learned a lot. Hey, I'm curious if we can learn a little bit more about your journey with Canis and just a little bit more about your journey period. I know in your bio we mentioned that a date, 2008, and I think that was a bit of a pivotal time for you. Yeah. Can you take us back to then or even earlier and share with us kind of how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, well, if I should go earlier than that, I've always had dogs growing up, but I would say that I probably, I'm not proud looking back of how I was running around with them as a child. I would say we did the best we could at that time and with what I knew, but I was a child. And I think that poor poodle had jumped over homemade agility equipment for like ages, which she probably shouldn't have. But from an early time, I had an interest in animal, dogs. I had a horse. I had a horse for quite a few years. Always liked being around animals, but I didn't really know a lot. And then I think in 2005, I got my first dog and started dog training with him. I just Googled dog training close local community and I found something and I started there. And after a few years, they kind of moved me from class to class up until the competitive obedience class. And the trainers in that dog club were really nice and they were awesome, but they were very tired of all my questions. Because I was thinking at that time, there was a horrible TV show, in my opinion, going on in Denmark, and everyone would learn to go to their dogs. And I saw that television show too, and I didn't know better. So I tried that and it didn't work. Obviously, I was very, very bad at doing anything in that way. And we talked about it at training, and I was always asking, but what if, and why do I do that? They say, so you'd go there and do this and then do this with your dog. And I was like, but why do I do that? And then eventually one trainer said, look, here's a clicker trainer education for you. I think you should do that. And I'm like, I know nothing about clicker training. I've never owned a clicker in my entire life. So I should add, we weren't training like punishment based, but it was a good mix, I would say, at that time. And I then somehow got convinced that that was a good idea to start the Canis clicker trainer education. Unfortunately, the dog I had at the time died, so I started it with a young pup who was, I think, 8 weeks and 2 days when we started the first workshop. And then it just kind of went from there. And there I was very welcome to ask all my questions. I did not understand a thing. I remember walking into that room and seeing all these people who have been training dogs for years. They all had perfect equipment and very well-behaved dog. And they were, I remember the first day they were talking about like we needed to know basic stuff, so they were what we are going through. So they mentioned flooding, and I remember I was looking around and I was going, everybody's nodding. Is this a situation where I pretend that I know what they're talking about? And I just raised my hand and I was like, what is flooding? And everyone was super kind to me and explained all that stuff. And then it kind of just went from there. As soon as I finished the train education in Denmark, I applied to the instructor's course for Norway, which is a 1-year education too. And got accepted, and then I've never looked back. I remember thinking it was a hoax in the beginning. I was like, yeah, no, I don't think we can do all of that just when we don't in this way of training, but they proved me wrong. So I loved that. The only side effect was that now in the dog club, they were thinking I was too noisy. I should move somewhere else with my clicker. but that changed after a few years. And I'm very happy that today the entire club is doing clicker training and has all the instructors, certified clicker trainers. So that's quite a turn they did.
So that's the same club and you're still involved with that same club?
Yeah, I am. They have taken a huge shift. All the trainers are really curious about learning, not only about clicker training, but learning about positive reinforcement training in all aspects. And it's really been amazing because everybody's using their free time there. Everybody is... everybody's volunteering when they teach classes there. I teach a class there too every week. So it's just nice to see how everything has changed from doing like alpha roles or whatever we would call them to now actually thinking ABCs instead. I love that.
And you mentioned to me prior to pushing record about being at that club and I'm gonna quote you here so you can tell me if I've completely butchered it. Were you told that you are asking too many questions?
Yeah. Well, I would say in like a fun and playful way that I was asking too many questions.
Like, but if you are told it in a fun and playful way or a fun and playful way?
Well, I think it was supposed to be in a fun and playful way, but if you hear it every week, there might be some actual truth to it. And I get that. I completely understand why they would think that, because they were using their free time and it wasn't very normal at that time to use a lot of your own free time and money to educate yourself to go teach other people in your free time. So I get why it was annoying to have me ask all those questions, why I wouldn't just do what they say. And I don't struggle with authorities normally, not a lot at least. But I don't know why. I think I was just curious and I was really interested in all this stuff. I really wanted to learn it. I think one of my friends described it as I went all in. And I think that's a pretty good description. They said your focus shifted complete from having 100 different things to zooming into dog training and learning. And I think that's probably true. I found something I was passionate about.
What was it, do you think, that caught your focus at that time?
Well, at first I think it was seeing that I could teach an animal something, so that my behavior, so thinking back now, at the time it was just this is fun, but thinking back now it was probably that how much my behavior could change someone else's behavior, in this case my first dog. how little I have to change and how reinforcing it was for me whenever the dog would get anything right. I think that's probably what made me really interested in it, noticing how huge an impact I would have. And then as soon as I started canis, trying to apply it to other aspects of my life, work situation, working with people. I remember I took, as part of the instructor's course, there's days where you go to a course with Eva Bertelsen and Emily Jensen-Ree, and they have tech teach and agility there. So learning about this tech teach, I didn't go home and apply tech teach right away because I wasn't good enough to do that. I needed to explore it more. But I realized that the principles that I was using with my dog, I could use them with my, well, with everyone around me. And so I tried gradually applying it to colleagues at the day job I had at that time, applying it to my boss when we were doing negotiations, all that stuff. And that was really reinforcing to figure out how all that would work.
Can you share any stories about specifically how you applied that in negotiations, you said?
Oh.
You can say, I can't talk about that if you can't talk about it.
Well, no, I can. I probably shouldn't mention like super specific, but then again, I don't think that the people in question would be listening to anything about animal training. I took that in with how just trying when you do like the first negotiation part, at least in Denmark, we did that. So you had a first meeting and you had to decide. So how has your work been the past year? What are we going to do? Are we giving you more in salary? Are we not? And all that stuff. And I was thinking, okay, so what if I apply these things? And every time he says something I like, I lean in, I open up like my body language, I lean in and I nod and I'm like being really engaged and saying good things back. And if he said, oh, you've been working so hard this year, and I would say, oh, but that's because I have such a great role model to show me how. You know, so just kind of really reinforcing everything good and then absolutely not reinforcing anything I didn't like. So that's probably the big picture in it, but it really moved a lot. And I talked to him when I stopped that job, and he said he went in there and wanted to give me like nothing or 2%, and I came out with I think 10%, which was quite a lot at that for that jump. And he said, I never understood. I went home to my wife and I said, I don't know what just happened. I have no idea. This little lady came and she completely ran me over. And his wife asked him, was she mean? Did she yell at you? And he was like, no, I have no idea what happened. I left with a different agreement than what I wanted. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. So that was kind of a highlight for me. Well, highlight, that sounds horrible. It's not like I'm thinking we should do that when we go into negotiations, but it was a wake-up call for me how much he actually left the meeting happy but not knowing what happened, and I could change his behavior without him being uncomfortable at any feeling that he lost anything, because that's usually how negotiations ends. One part feels that they lose, and he didn't feel that. He just didn't understand what happened because he wasn't really used to that approach, I guess. So that was interesting for me. That was probably just after the seminar with Eva and Emily.
That's quite an impressive accomplishment in a sitting to go through.
Well, maybe it was just luck. I don't know.
Have you had other negotiations since then with similar results?
No, because I haven't negotiated anything since. That was the last job I had before then I shifted to dog training.
Then you negotiated your life to do exactly what you wanted. Hey, yeah. I think everyone's been in the boat where they're like, should I put my hand up or should I just smile and nod and pretend I know what everyone's talking about? And we talk about an Animal Training Academy being brave learners, and I feel like that's a part of it. Like, is that, would you label yourself as brave in that canis course back then? Like, is that, like, as an instructor now, when you have a room full of students, like, yeah, are you wanting them to be like you wanting that level of like, and how do we get that? Because I feel like a lot of people might, because you're vulnerable when you do that, right? You might get a reaction like, what are you, stupid?
You know, exactly.
You open yourself up for that. Like, how do we get that curious?
Well, I think that actually the positive reinforcement community is so supportive and welcome and encouraging curiosity. And I love that. Looking back now, yes, I actually would say that I made a conscious decision that no, I was still for the first half hour. And then I was like, I've already paid for the course, but I'm thinking it's too much money for me to sit there and just smile and not learn anything. There was the examination, and there was like a written examination and practical. So I was also aware that if I didn't understand it, how would I ever move forward? So I'm thinking in some terms, yes, it didn't feel like I was being brave at the time, but that's what I would love to have in my classroom today. I would love people to ask questions. I usually stop when I'm teaching if I see someone like frowning a bit, or you see their facial expressions change, and I'll just ask to the entire room, does that make sense? Because I don't want to call them out, but I also really want them to say no. And by saying, does that make sense? I'm not saying, do you understand? I am hopefully making it safe for them to say, no, it doesn't make sense. Okay, then it's me not making sense. I will try to say something else. So I'm trying to create a safe space. But I do think that, I think it's a balance, because I think it's a struggle also with social media, because you can be very, very smart and know a lot on social media because you have time to look stuff up. And I will do that. If there's anything I'm doubting, I will look it up and make sure that I'm actually replying the right thing. And when you're live on the spot, you get so much immediate feedback from people's reaction. And you see that little eye roll, and you see that looking to the side, is she asking another question? So I think it's a balance, but I think we really need to encourage curiosity, and we really need to to welcome it. And I think I learned, and I don't even remember who it was, which is one of the things I am terrified about, saying something to you that someone else said to me that I need to quote them on. But I know that all these amazing trainers share so much great knowledge, and at some point you hear it enough time and you say it so many times that it's kind of feels like you are saying it, and you forget who said it. But basically, probably someone else said everything I said before me. That's probably how it is. So I don't remember who said it, but it was a phrase when I asked a question where someone said, that's a really interesting question, or that's an interesting comment. And looking back, I see now that wasn't an interesting question at all, what I had, because they pretty much just replied it. I just didn't understand it. But I'm using that phrase a lot to questions when they are interesting, or even if I've just explained them, because it is interesting no matter what. Because if I get a question that I've just explained, then it is interesting to me, because then it's because I haven't explained it good enough. It's not on the learner to have the responsibility to understand. It's my responsibility to share what I want in a way that's easy accessible. And if it's not clear in the first way I say it, I need to say it in another way, or I need to show it, or I need to demonstrate it. So I really think that's a good phrase. I think that's an encouraging phrase to say, that's an interesting question, or that's really interesting, because it also makes the person who's saying it feel like you're actually adding value to the conversation. You're not just trying to say something, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I like the way you explain that. It is interesting, and because I mean, people could just kind of become robots, and like someone asked a question, all right, now say that was an interesting question. But like, yeah. It is, because as you said, like it resonates with me that it's your responsibility to explain things in a way that your learners understand, so there's an opportunity there for you as an instructor to grow and try new things out.
Make sure that everyone leaves with something. Everyone learns something. Me too, when I'm teaching. I learn a lot every time I'm teaching, but I really also want the people there to feel like they learned something, that they weren't just placed in a chair an entire day and came home with nothing. So that's my responsibility to make that come across in some way for them.
Would you say that 2021 Katja has the same curiosity or the same approach to curiosity in a learning environment to 2008, Katja. Have you, did you like take feedback then and be like, okay, cool, I've got to like change how I'm curious, or were you just like in a learning environment?
Yeah, I would say I'm more curious now probably than I was then, because the more, again, the more I learn, the more I don't know. But I did take something away. I took something away from how I wanted to respond when someone is curious. I took away from when it's when there's also something I can look up instead of asking 100 times, because that's easier for me. Everyone is. I don't mind everyone asking me anything they could look up. I welcome that. But I was kind of like a, I don't even know what you call them. I was kind of like a Velcro thing that just stuck to people all the time, and being like, but if, and then what, and then what, but what if, I don't understand, which was probably not the nicest way for people to have someone ask questions. So I learned something from that, but I would say I'm more curious today. And I think what really hit it for me in regards of, well, you know, we reach a point where we've learned a lot and we feel like now we know it. I'm like, now I know it. I got this. I am completely sure of this when I finished the first course. And then I went to a seminar, and I remember it was, I think it was 2009, the year after the first course. But at that time, that was like a pretty high education in Denmark. So I was like, I got it. I know it all now. And it was Morten and Cecilia did a presentation, and Kesi Sadeo did a presentation. She did two, I think. So it was like a weekend workshop. I remember sitting there feeling like, really? Yeah, let's see what they got. I know this. And just as Kesi finished, I was like, I know nothing. I know nothing at all. This isn't true. She's making stuff up. It's not true. Then she came the next day with a presentation, sorry, that once again completely blew me away, and I realized how little I actually knew. And that was a very awesome moment and a very humbling moment for me also. And I'm glad that I got it that early, because I think we all reach a point when we start out that where we think now we know it, we finished, and then we learn that we are not. But that's the awesome thing, because that's what makes us investigate new things and makes us seek out new learning opportunities. And for the seminar with Kathy, something I smile when I'm thinking of it, because I got such a lovely memory of her talking about the pre-med principle and how it could be done. And I went up and I talked to her, because I was still a bit skeptic, and I was saying, but I have a dog who will chase birds, and he will do this, and he will chase mice. And so are you saying that I could actually, by giving him access to that, I could increase another behavior that I would like? And she was like, yeah, sure, absolutely. You can make the other behavior more likely and make that behavior less likely. And I was thinking, nah, I'm not sure. But she said, yes, you can do it. Okay, so I went home and I did all the work, and I bought plastic dogs and I put them on a leash and I pulled them so it was like birds, and I did it with mice. And then I met Kathy at the first Clicker Expo, and I said to her, oh, I just wanted to thank you for sharing this information with me, because it really worked. And she looked at me and she was like, did you do that? And I was like, yes. Oh, you were you able to do that? And I was like, what do you mean? You said it could be done. And she was like, I just remember that moment of her laughing and me laughing, because obviously it could be done, but she probably didn't expect me to like take it very literally and just go home and follow her guidebook, which was an amazing experience for me, where we ended up showing her videos of this work being done. So that was like a wake up moment for me, her giving her presentation and making me realize how little I knew. And then at the same time, providing me with new skills to take my learning to the next step. Yeah, that was kind. I liked that she reinforced my curiosity at that time. She could have just given me a standard reply, but she took her time and explained to me how I could do it. And then I believed it. So I did it, which is kind of awesome now for me, thinking I only did it because she said I could. Otherwise, I would never have tried this. And yeah. And then she was there laughing at it at the conference later. That's such a nice memory.
That's awesome. That's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. Hey, looking at the time, let's move on. But just before we do, can you share with everyone 2021? What It's a very odd time to be asking this question, but what fills your days now and where can people go to find you online?
Well, obviously, I'm not able to do a lot of travel. Unfortunately, I'm so bummed out about all the things we had to cancel because of travel restrictions. So what I'm doing now is mostly online. And we're just opening up here so I can do some workshops in Denmark. But I'm eagerly waiting so I get to go to England again and get to travel again. So mainly right now, I am doing my courses on the Trumplo platform, where I do online courses there. That's the main thing right now. And then I have my online one-to-ones. But that's pretty much it right now. I like working online with people, but I really also like having like a hands-on thing. I like meeting people. So I miss workshops like crazy. So unfortunately, it's not a huge program yet because I do have some things in the calendar, but we are waiting all the time to figure out if it's even realistic to start arranging stuff. So currently I'm focusing a bit on training my youngest dogs, and hopefully he can start going out and competing. And I'm exploring different opportunities for learning, different educations I can learn from home. Challenging my comfort zone a bit and working more with my child and with other people's children, which other people's children are not something I've done a lot earlier. So that's been like 19 and 20 has been the year of that, I guess. So I'm guessing I'm finding my balance in how the world will look, and I'm just trying to adjust on a daily basis, as many others are, I assume.
And I'm enjoying watching your exploration of teaching with Colin and in that space, and you've been working with Emily Johnson Bay a little bit.
Yeah.
Through their choice control and communication platform.
Yeah, we have. We did a presentation on cooperative care for kids on the CCC conference, and we're doing that presentation on ABC 24/7 later this month. And we just did a webinar together on COVID tests for kids. So the kids stuff, I do that with Emily. We also did like an online course a while ago on it, a 6-week self-auditor only online course it was, because that's the thing. It's difficult doing online learning with children if you give people a deadline. If you're like, and by next week, this is the homework, you will easily end in a situation where we end up pushing or not checking, if the child is actually on board with this, because we just want to deliver our homework. So I find it's a balance actually to do this. I find that the best thing we can do is to share information and make people curious to go explore it on their own, without setting expectations for them about what they should do, but just hopefully inspire a bit.
And I believe some Tyrannosaurus rexes might have been getting some COVID tests as well. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, actually, no, it was a Spinosaurus. But
my apologies. Yeah. I'm sorry to Colin. I didn't realize.
Gotta know your dinosaurs, Ryan. probably they all have had a COVID test. He's enjoying that game now, and I really appreciate him. I don't really appreciate him waking me up at 2 o'clock in the morning asking if we should play COVID test. But I also do appreciate it, because if that's the first thing he thinks of when he woke up, that would mean that my training what we've practiced has worked, and it's now like a fun game for him. And he really likes it. We can barely drive past the test center without him asking if we should go in and have a test. And then he will decide whether or not it's me who needs it, or if we should go to the children's area. And I like doing that presentation with Emily, because I think it's a valuable skill right now. And we took two very different approaches to it, because our learners are different ages. But the fact that we can get something out there where people can see that we can do it without force and without holding their mouth open. I really hope that people will see that and feel inspired to just try bits of it. They don't have to do anything of what we did, but maybe they can come up with their own way. Maybe they can even come up with a better way than what we did. But just the fact that they will try to actually give some choice, some level of choice, I would love to see that. And I'm at least very happy with what Colin did with it. I'm not worried about any COVID test with him anymore. So.
It's a beautiful worry to remove. What I love about, well, there's many things I love about that video, but one thing that I love is that dinosaurs are part of the reinforcement for Colin, and he wears dinosaur clothing while he's doing the COVID testing. And I just realized that he's got part of his reinforcement on his clothing. And then looking at, you guys can't see Katya right now, but you have clothing as well with like part of your reinforcement on it, because your clothing says be a kind human.
Yeah.
So, you know, props to you guys for pushing a reinforcement-based clothing fashion. Seems out here as well.
Well, apparently we are drawn to stuff that we like. But I would say it's hard to catch Colin a day where he's not wearing anything with a dinosaur, though. If he has anything to say, it will be all dinosaurs. And yeah, I just accepted that. I'm not loving the dinosaur outfits, but on the other hand, he is, and he's the one wearing it, so he gets to decide.
Hey, thanks so much for sharing everything so far, Katya. Just one last thing. I don't think I've ever been to your website. Where do people go to find you?
So the website we have is in Scandinavian language. I am building an English one, but it takes a bit of time. So what I am using mainly right now is my Facebook page. And that's just called Kenny's Katya Pedersen. So that's where I share stuff, share if I do videos or if I see something that I really feel like people need to know, see something interesting or courses, that's where I share stuff. Because I'm thinking that not many people speak the Scandinavian language after all. So I can send them there, but I don't think they will understand the text.
Well, we can use Google Translator because the information is valuable.
But we do have the Kenny's Academy website, but there's not that much on it yet either.
Hey, thanks so much for sharing everything so far. Like I said, we love hearing about people's behavioral odysseys, so we really appreciate that. Moving forward, though, I'm excited to learn from you about, or learn more from you, I should say, about something that is dear to my heart at the moment. Every day I get to experience my master brave learner, at the time of this recording, nearly 15-month-old daughter, Summer. And I'm so conscious of how everything that I've learned in my life feels like it has prepared me for this learner as I watch her interact with the world and I watch the world interact with her. It's incredibly joyous. You've been experiencing something similar, I imagine, although for slightly longer with Colin for 4 years now. And as parents, I think to say that everyone's experience is the same as mine, I think we often reflect on our time with our non-human learners and the similarities in how we set the stage for learning to be fun and full of reinforcement for our human learners. But I want to flip the coin on this today, though, and ask for you to share with us the opposite. 5 things that raising a 4-year-old human learner has taught you about working with dogs, working with non-humans. I'm pumped to hear what you've come up with. So can you get us started with 1?
Yeah, well, so I found that really tricky because I was thinking mostly the other way around, because that's kind of the order I got it in, working with animals and then a child. But I was thinking that so when I'm doing any sort of practice with Colin, I have the benefit of verbal behavior. So I have the benefit of no, or when he was younger, waving arms. It was very clear no. And what I found is it made me more aware how food can trick me when I'm training animals. it can trick me into thinking that we are still in a good training session because the animal isn't walking away. So Colin would walk away no matter what was there. If I, for some reason, wasn't clear, if I didn't set the stage for the behavior in a good way, he would just walk away. And dogs don't really do that in the same sense. If you're still holding food and they want that food, you can kind of convince them to stay, even though if you play the video back later and look at their behaviors and how all those tiny behaviors change, that they probably would have left early on if you weren't holding all that food in front of them. So it's made me more aware of being conscious of how I offer food, and also to offer food as an opt-out. So do some training and throw some treats on the grass. And I can see if I throw 5 treats on the grass and they only pick up 4 and then come back, then we are really in a training session. If they start sniffing for the crumbs, like intensely sniffing, then that's probably where I should have ended for my dogs. It's different, obviously, from dog to dog. But I see that clear now. And I did not see that before. I was just thinking, well, as long as you're not starting scratching yourself or sniffing yourself or, well, barking or walking away, if we should go to the extremes, then you are here and we are training and we are both having a good time, I assume. But seeing that with Colin has made me aware of how the little signs matters. It shouldn't be necessary for our learners to bend everything in neon for us to understand what they are saying. The observational skills has gotten better for me. And it's probably both ways around. So I've probably taken that with me to Colin. So I think it's kind of a ping pong situation. I learn something from Colin. I take it back when I work with my dogs, and then I take it back when I work with Colin. Yeah. So that would be like my thing that I see I have really changed.
And you put that down to verbal behavior and Colin being able to tell you?
Well, I think for me, this was mostly the, it's easier. It's much easier for me to work with nonverbal learners because I'm not tempted to explain to them what I want them to do. So now when Colin is actually speaking, I have to stop myself from not explaining too much. I have to remember to give him tag points. I can give him an explanation, but I need to remember to narrow it down to a tag point. I get too much background noise when I'm allowed to explain a lot. So keeping it clean and the information short and sweet and bite-sized is absolutely something I like to do. So I would say for me, nonverbal learners are easier. So that I've come to appreciate with my dogs, that I cannot just tell them what I want them to do. Well, I can, but it's not happening if they don't know the cue for it. Then it's just going to be me talking. But for this other thing, it was mostly for me about the food, that I need to make sure that the same reinforcement they can get the same for doing another known behavior. So if you choose to go to your mat instead, you will get the exact same outcome as if you stay with me and do healing, for instance. So that is something that I've become very much aware with. So I think that working with Colin has taught me that I need to always have two known choices that the dogs can do and get the same outcome. That would probably be one of the big things for me.
So I've taken away from it that number one is your observation skills have gotten better as a result of all of this.
Hopefully. I would hope so.
Or was there more than one lesson? I mean, there was obviously more than one lesson in there. I'm a numerical podcast host. I'm like, what is the number one that I can repeat? No, joking. What else? Take us more into your journey. What else has your human learner taught you about working with non-human learners?
It has learned me, because I'm very aware with Colin that I will make sure I have evaluated before we start whether or not there's a choice. Not offering a choice if there's none. And that I have taken with me to the animals too. So if we are going in, so they will do husbandry behaviors. When I go to the vet, they will do the chin rest. But if I go into, so earlier on, years ago, I would have gone in and I would have asked for a chin rest, even if I know they were, I don't know, emptying the anal glands, which I know the cocker hates, which would make him break the chin rest. And I would still ask for a chin rest. And then when we came to now you're about to do it, I would be like a bit more, oh, I need to hold you too. And then they would do it. And then we would maybe do a chin rest afterwards. But thinking of it now, I'm not doing that anymore because we are in a situation when there's no choice. And if I ask for a chin rest, I am implying that you are in a situation where you get to decide whether or not we proceed. So doing a chin rest and then removing it and saying, now we're going to do it. And then we do the chin rest again. It's just putting makeup on it for me. It's just me making it look pretty for myself. Oh, and then we still had the chin rest and he wanted to participate. So I think it's something about making me feel good. So I've changed that to when there is no choice and we are in a situation that we are not probably prepared for, or I know will trick you. So for Kokyo, it will be rubber gloves. Anytime someone would put on, no, not a latex glove. Anytime anyone would put those on, he will run because he had so many issues with that. Asking him to do a chin rest is not something I would do anymore. And I've learned that from working with Colin, because offering him a choice when there's none, that's not fair. And he's loud enough to tell me. The dogs don't always do that because everything goes so quickly and there's a vet there and they will just maybe hold the collar. But I've really become aware of not only being aware of whether or not there's a choice with humans, but also when I work with animals. So that has been one of the big things for me. And that's one of the things I've discussed a lot with Emily also, that is, don't offer choice if there's none. So if I ask for something, if I give the choice, I have to follow through. I can't say, do you... well, I have examples when I say, do you want to go to daycare? And he says, no. And I'm like, oh, okay. But I have to be somewhere soon. That was stupid of me. I gave him a choice and there actually wasn't a choice. That's on me. So instead we will do something else. Then I will say, okay, then we will go look at the cows or the horses and we will drive and we will drive a detour to the cows and the horses. And then we will look at them for 5 minutes and then we will go back into the car and I will say, okay, now we go to daycare. Then I'm remembering not to offer the choice when there isn't one. But that's the thing. We are posing all these questions to our human learners and asking them to we're actually not even listening for the answers. It's just something we do because I would do it if I'm talking to you. We would do it when we're talking to other adults. But doing that to a child is somehow not fair, especially not if we're trying to teach them that their behavior matters. Then it's not fair to put it that way. So I've taken that part away from my dogs too. I'm trying to not offer them choice if there's none. Usually I can provide them with a high level of choice, but in the past I would also pretend they have a choice even when they didn't. And thinking back, it felt like just putting makeup up on, just making it look a bit prettier because I should know how to do this. So it kind of felt like it was just for my sake, which was bad actually. But we, what is it we say? We do better when we know better.
I'm grateful for the bad. The bad helps us get to the air quotes. Good.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. And
sorry, go on.
No, I was just thinking that, having Colin react to me not respecting his choice for me making a bad decision is what made me aware of that's the same with the animals, except for they are not reacting. They are not starting to whine or bark at me when I still do the procedure, even though they said no. But why would I ever ask for consent if I'm not listening anyway? It's kind of the thing that I don't know if you do it in New Zealand. It's a Ewa thing where people ask, how are you? Hi, how are you? They do it in, I think, UK too. Hi, how are you? And the first time I was like, I'm fine, thanks. I'm feeling a bit tired, but I'm fine. How are you? And it took me a while to realize that no one really cares. No one was. So they were asking questions that they really didn't want to reply on. And now I get it. Now I get it's a cultural thing and that's just how you do. And I'm being rude if I'm not thinking of it because we don't do that in Denmark. We don't ask that. If someone asks me in Denmark, how are you? That's because they want to know how I'm feeling. So I'm kind of feeling that when we give the child a choice and there's none, it's the same as asking a question where you're not interested in hearing the answers. And then it's probably better that we not even ask the question.
It's even across like different countries and cultures and Western society. I know I used to work with someone from Bristol. My wife's from Bristol, but Bristol, they say, "You're right. Are you all right? You're all right." And I started answering, and I was like, "Hang on." And then they walked away. I'm like, "I see." I had the same, but it's like I know that because I am in a country where we do say, "How are you?"
Yeah.
And you're right. It's not met with. It's not asked with sincerity.
No, and if you're not used to it, so I guess it's a nice thing. I'm not trying to bash everyone in the US and UK. So I guess it's a nice thing. But if you're not used to it, I remember the first time I was in England and I was walking a hallway and someone in the hotel said, "Are you all right, love?" And I was like, "Love? Who are you? Why would you? I've never met you before." And then I met the next person who was a nice cleaning lady and she said the same, "Are you all right, love?" And I was like, oh, okay, it's just something we say. So for me, that would be very unnatural. That's not what we do in Denmark. It's just we would not. Yeah, we would give a nod. Hello. Hi, hi. That's probably what we would do. But you wouldn't ask or like give people these sweet nicknames if you don't know anyone. So that's a funny experience. And it took me a while to learn, actually.
I'm tempted to jump down rabbit holes of culture, but let's stay on track. I like your example of Colin and on Interlock there. Just Colin said, you say to Colin, "Hey, do you want to go to daycare?" Colin says no, and you take him to see the cows, for example. So with that in mind, acknowledging resources and resource scarcity is something that we all deal with, whether now or at some point in our lives. The next day when it's time for Colin to go to daycare, what is your approach there?
Then my approach would be, as soon as we're ready to leave, he would get his clothes on and I would say, "Okay, let's go to the car so we can drive to daycare." Mm-hmm. And if I see him being, and I'm not going to offer him the choice again, because hopefully I've learned. Let's say hopefully, because sometimes I do, because it's such a natural part of our language to ask these questions that isn't really a question anyway. But if I see him being like, nope, he doesn't really want, I would say, so it's time to go to the car. Let's drive to the daycare. Let's see if we can see the dinosaurs on the way. And so I live in the country and there's always machines doing some harvesting. And then a new mark has been harvested and we will stop maybe for a second or just drive past and say, "Oh, look, they made a dinosaur sandbox in there." And then he will look for dinosaur footprints and all that stuff from the car. So it's just turning into an eventful ride instead to the daycare. So I'm trying to make all the rides to daycare into a fun event to hopefully also make it less likely that he will say no when I again ask him if he wanted to go to daycare, because that's the realistic thing. I'm going to ask it again at one point because I forget that he's a child that doesn't understand rhetorical questions.
What else? What else has Colin taught us, you, now?
What else? Well, he has... So I would think, I would say I knew it before, but I've been more aware now of not working when you're on a deadline. That is really something that I feel that we pay for when we're working with children. We really pay a high price for being on a deadline. So the worst thing for me is when someone asks me, "Could you send me a video of this?" And I'm like, yeah, sure. And then I forget it. And then I have to do it 5 minutes before deadline, which is probably... maybe it could be, but often not the time where Colin wants to do this kind of game with me. And then it gets pushy. So I'm trying to avoid that. And that is also something that I know I shouldn't do with my animals, but I've done it a lot in the past, thinking I just have 5 minutes. And then I've aimed at some behavior that was huge, thinking, oh, I could just do this, or I need it done because I need a video of it. So I've become much more aware of how much being on a deadline affects me. Not my learner. They are able to do if I made the right setup, but I don't make the right setup if I'm on too tight a deadline. I cut corners without thinking of it, but because probably time matters and let's get there in a hurry. And you can probably do it. You know, all the things where you're telling yourself it's probably going to be okay. But deep down, you know that it's not really okay. And I've learned that I've been more considerate of that now with my animals, to not just push things through, because it's easier to do with them. You can easier just up whatever food or toy you're giving them and then get a bit more than what you actually feel good about, which I've become much more aware of not to do, not to aim for doing these sessions when I'm on too tight a deadline, or if I, for other reason, don't have the energy to do it, if I'm too stressed out by something else. So if I'm not there, we shouldn't be doing any training. If I'm not, well, I'm there, but if I'm not really there, then I've learned to not do the training. And you should think that I knew that already, and I probably did, but I wasn't as aware of it as I am now. I'm really trying to take better time to do my videos now and to do my sessions with my dogs. So I'm trying to make an antecedent arrangement that works better for me.
Yeah, I can hear that. You sound very zen.
Well, nah, not sure Sen and me is ever something used in the same sentence, but
I hear you. Like, I mean, the last 12 months for me have been challenging resource-wise, and it's hard to make those in resource-scarce situations to always live what we preach.
Yeah. And yet you've been managing to do so much amazing training with Phoebe. I saw in ATA, you've managed to keep up your training sessions. I was really impressed with you having a child and learning all these skills that we are learning when we become parents, because where should we have learned them before we got parents? And still managing to run ATA and do some training sessions as well. I'm really impressed that you seem like you can just do it all.
Yeah, but I mean, I think what I'm learning from you today in this podcast episode is that I'm resonating with these things. Like, I do place that pressure on myself of deadlines and making videos and staying up to this image that you're relaying back to me right now. But I mean, in reality, and something that I'm okay to talk about on here because I've shared with our membership and our wider community, is creating that world has costs, right? Like, and you burn out. And so I think there's a line for me, and I don't know, you know, I'm just sharing my experience here. I don't know of others in the audience, but judging from the conversations we have in our membership, you've seen the ones, Katia, about how people process some of this stuff. Is, I don't even know where I'm going with that. It's gone. It's challenging to always be mindful.
Yeah,
mindful, as you said, because you might forget with Colin to not ask a rhetorical question, and so when I say you're zen. What I mean is I'm working hard as an individual to be as mindful as that, because I catch myself not doing training when I maybe shouldn't be doing training, or realizing that I've just done that to try to reach some imaginary deadline, or offering choice when there isn't a choice, and then in hindsight you're like, I know this.
Yeah, but I think it's life, and it's these new times where, I don't know how everyone else is feeling, but I am also in a situation where I feel like I am saying yes to a lot of stuff faster than I normally would, because things are changing, and we're like, yes, I want to be a part of that. I'm completely deprived from hanging out with colleagues, so I want to do that. I am not able to do courses. Oh, you want me to do a course on that? Yes, sure. Even though I might not have the time, but because things are uncertain for many of us, work-wise, financially, future-wise, everything. So I also feel that we make decisions, or at least I make decisions that I make too quickly. So I am practicing saying, let me get back to you on that tomorrow, so that I can actually figure out, is this really something I want to do? Or am I just saying yes because I'm desperate to do something with someone? I think probably many others could be in the same situation where many people are trying to do daycare by themselves, homeschooling while they are still running their business and taking care of their job. They're trying to, well, just activate their dogs. And that's what we see. So if you're in a situation with a small child and you have to have them at home for a long time due to restrictions. And all you see on Facebook or on other social media is how much you should activate your dog, what you should do with them, all that stuff that makes you feel guilty when you're not doing it. Then we try to do it without having the time. And I think, so it's not like someone is, I don't feel like anyone is shaming us for not doing it, but it's the thing where we feel like we should do it, we want to do it. And then we are trying to compensate by using 5 minutes here and there, because now I just have the time. And it often ends up with me, or it used to often end up with me, realizing that there's 10 minutes till I need to drive and pick up Colin. Let me do 5 minutes with each dog. And that's like a setup for disaster, because one is deaf and blind and the other one wants to take part in everything because he knows the other one is deaf and blind. So that's like, I need a much better setup. So I needed to stop doing that. But I think it's also part of we want it to be perfect. We want to share the perfect image of doing all this. But we also need to embrace that this has been over a year for most people, that their life has been turned upside down. And it's okay that we're not superhumans. It's okay that we go to the vet or to the doctor with our child and we don't have the behaviors that we would like. But we can try to then make it the best situation possible with what we have available at that time. But we shouldn't. I think it's important that we embrace that it's okay that we can't do it all. We would like to, but we can't. I have no idea where I was going with that, but there it is.
Very human side of... Doesn't make any sense. I was going to say the human side of being human.
The human side of being a human. No, but we can pretend that. We can say that's a thing. The human side of being a human.
Yeah. Let's call this podcast episode The Human Side of Being Human.
Yeah, hey, that's a good name.
I think we got through three there, but three really meaningful points. You talked about observation skills have gotten better through Colin being able to talk, versus your dogs being able to talk, and you having to not, you catching yourself trying to explain things too much, and kind of the value of coming back to tag points, and these little ways of testing how your dog's feeling about things by doing scatter feeds. And then you talked about not offering a choice if there is no choice.
Yeah.
So there's going to be a lot of confused people walking around after listening to this podcast show saying, should I ask the person how they are? Do I actually care? Do I have time to stick around?
Do I have time to hear how she's really feeling? Or
I mean, because if you do wait sincerely to listen to how someone's really feeling, like, you better be prepared for,
yeah,
like Colin stopping and looking at the cows.
Yeah.
And your last one you shared with us was not working when you're on a deadline.
Yeah.
Did you quickly want to add some more? Because looking at the time, we're going to have to...
No, I think I've talked a lot about those points, but I would think that, yeah. No, don't say deadline. Don't use that word. I'm thinking that if I should say something quickly, I've really noticed, I already knew that distractions matter a lot, but working with Colin has made me realize how much they really matter, and how easy it is to camouflage that if you're working with a dog, how easy it is to make it look like really good training, even when there's distractions there, by tweaking a few things. But when then working with Colin and realizing how much it matters and how much he could shut down in a complete different environment just because now someone was staring at him that he didn't know, or he was in a different room, made me realize that that's again a thing of me camouflaging, that it's me knowing what to do. So I don't know if we can say it's me pulling the behavior, it's pulling the behavior out without being too literal, but it's kind of me having enough experience to get the behavior in that setting. It's not because I've done the foundation very well then. And that is kind of my thing, that is doing foundation. So it was a good reminder to me to go back and do a lot of training in an undistracted environment. So I guess that's it. And the last one I put down there is to I've been more aware of setting my criteria for the first repetitions lower than I would normally do. And that is definitely something Colin has taught me, where I would usually go in and say, that's where we stop, that's where we start. And that usually goes with the dogs. but it didn't go with Colin. And it might even still go with the dogs, but it feels better to start at that safe space where I'm a bit lower in my criteria and I know it works. And then I can do like a giant leap after that, because then we are already in the loop. So that is really paying off for me to start lower than normally.
Well, I feel like I'm Katja in 2008 and I have a million questions, but I'm going to rein them in. We are going to hit towards the end. Thank you for sharing those two as well. And I think they're two podcast episodes in and of themselves. I know that I am learning a lot from you at the moment, Katja. You've been kind enough to share some of your work with me, and we've been connecting more and more, even though you've been a member for years. We are working more closely together now. So I'm relishing these opportunities and grateful for them, and grateful for what you're sharing with our community. I'm curious about you, though. Just to wrap up, what do you want to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in our animal training world?
Well, I think what I want the most is to see that everyone who is interested in learning about positive reinforcement training, whether that being with animals or with humans, that they would get the opportunity to learn, that we somehow would be able to provide everyone that's interested with that opportunity. And that we would be really good at not frowning at people who come from a different background. I really hope that that would happen. I think that even if you are doing it in a way that I would usually not applaud, if we talk together and you move just an inch in what you do, it's still so much better than being stuck. And that goes for all of us. I should also keep moving inches forward all the time and learn from a lot of people. So I think the biggest thing for me would be just giving everyone the platform to learn, giving them a safe space where they can go and learn if they're interested. And I think we can do that if we're just aware of offering as much kindness, each of us, as we can master at that giving time. Obviously, it's going to be different from day to day and from where we are in our life. But if we're able to offer kindness in the best way we can, I think we have the ability to move a lot of things. We just need to remember that not everyone comes from the same background and not everyone has had the same chances. So yeah, let's reach out and reinforce that curiosity. There's probably a lot of people who are curious and wants to learn. And if we don't close a circle pretending, then we, not pretending, but if we don't close down and say, no, we are the trainers and you are the student, I think we can learn a lot from those people. So I guess, yeah, reinforce that curiosity and be curious about their side too. Am I going Zen now? No, I don't think
I am.
Yeah,
I was going to say, this has been Talking Zen with Katja Pedersen. No, thank you so much, Katja, for making time to hang out with us today and for sharing everything that you have with us at Animal Training Academy and with our audience. Do you want to just take an opportunity just to remind everyone where they can go to find Canis and Katja and everything that you've been talking about today online?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's been lovely hanging out with you. Yeah, and if anyone is interested in anything, it would be on my Facebook page, which would be Canis Katja Pedersen. That's where you would find pretty much everything about me.
Beautiful, and we will link to that in the show notes. This has been so much fun from myself and on behalf of everyone listening. Once again, Katja, we really appreciate you taking the time to come and hang out with us. It's very appreciated.
Thank you so much for having me again.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much, everyone, for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.